Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly and today I'm joined by Dr. Josh Turknet. Hi, Josh.
Hello.
Josh is a neurologist and I first became aware of his work in 2014 when I attended the Ancestral Health Symposium in Berkeley, where Josh was presenting on the migraine as the hypothalamic distress signal. I was there in that lecture hall with my wife, Julie, and we both couldn't believe it because she had suffered from migraines in the past. And then she switched to a paleo diet. And can you guess what happened to her migraines, Josh?
Let me guess. They got better.
They got better. They went away completely. Absolutely brilliant. So maybe we could start this conversation by me asking you, why is you care about migraines so much? Tell me about your personal experience with migraines.
My experience with them is pretty much lifelong. So both my parents actually have them, but my mom had them even worse growing up. So for as long as I can remember, I can, you know, remember her dealing with them. It takes a lot to get her down. So, and I knew that whatever it was that would sort of take her out for, you know, days on end had to be something significant. So from an early age, I kind of despised whatever this thing was. And I knew they were, you know, she referred to them as migraines. And then, so, you know, probably I declared war on them from an early age. And then like when I was probably 10 or 11, mine first started, I have some early memories of some particularly bad ones, but they were, you know, pretty infrequent early on in my life and as a teenager, and then steadily worsened the older I got, probably partly related to the lifestyle and diet I was leading as I was, you know, doing my medical training and residency and so on. Ironically enough, in the field of neurology where, you know, migraines is,
oh my goodness,
our primary areas of expertise, right? So yeah, so mine, you know, steadily worsened over the years to the point where, you know, I had multiple per month. You know, it was basically a struggle for me to try to, you know, not miss days of work. I did well in that regard, but it was, you know, a constant everyday kind of battle trying to keep the headaches at bay with the available tools that I had, which was, you know, neurologists traditionally treat migraines with, the drugs that we have and so on. And for a long period of time, even though they were pretty bad, they'd gotten to several times a month, they were pretty severe enough to take a prescription medication and then sort of layered on top of that more lower level chronic headaches. But I thought I was doing the best I could do because, you know, here I was applying everything that I knew and that I would give to my patients to myself. So it felt like that I was, you know, this was kind of as good as it would get. And then, you know, made a switch probably at, I think around 2010, changed my diet lifestyle with zero expectation, you know, of it having any impact on my migraines. And lo and behold, like Julie's, you know, they vanished, which I thought was miraculous, which is why I decided to title my book, The Migraine Miracle, even though I'd be instantly skeptical of that title. But
it really is a miracle.
And most people who go through the experience, you know, they're like, oh, I get it now. You know, it's like, I went through this whole thing all my life and now they're gone and it doesn't seem like this should be possible.
Can you describe a migraine headache to someone that's never had one? So I've had a headache, but I've never had a migraine, I believe. Yeah. So can you describe the symptoms?
So migraines are kind of like a mini-armed beast. So there are all these different sort of pathophysiologic pathways that can be activated during the course of a migraine. And sort of we consider what's sometimes called a classical migraine as when all of those pathways are kind of turned on. And there are actually four phases. One of those phases is the pain phase, which is what gets the most attention. And I think the best, most helpful analogy is to compare it to sort of a drugs of abuse, like, you know, with something like heroin or opiates. You're basically going straight to your pleasure centers and turning them on in a way that nothing sort of in ordinary life is capable of doing, right? You're just going straight to the source and turning on those circuits. And that's why it's sort of been such a great experience that people want to do it again, because there's nothing else in their life that replicates it. And that's kind of the big downside to it as well. Same thing is true of migraine. You have the pain part of the brain being turned on in a way that sort of nothing in the course of everyday life would do. It's sort of the migraine process itself directly turning on the pain centers. It's a mixture of every possible type of cranial pain, you know, sensation all at one time. So you've got like throbbing pain that's super intense. You can have stabbing pain. You have this sort of diffuse achiness all over the skull combined with sort of these other disturbances in sort of autonomic function and sensory processing where you're exquisitely sensitive to lights or sounds. Nausea and vomiting is usually a big part. Oftentimes, you know, any type of movement will provoke vomiting and so on. So it's basically this sort of situation that you wouldn't never encounter in real life, where the whole pain system has gone awry and everything is kind of being switched on. And on a physiologic level, you have these feedback loops that are sort of self-perpetuating and amplifying over time, so that the whole thing is getting worse until something comes along to kind of burn it out or it ends. So yeah, it's one of those things that's incredibly hard to imagine unless you've been through it, particularly the worst of it. And it's actually fortunately hard to remember after the fact. So it's sort of like childbirth, I think, in that regard. You know, it's hard to imagine just how bad it was until you're in the midst of it. And then you do kind of forget. But yeah, it's miserable.
I'm sure it's one of those things, you know, I notice it in myself. And then we've heard clients say it too, is that, you know, once the problem is resolved, you just don't think about it anymore. You don't walk around thinking, oh, I'm so glad that I don't have a migraine, or I'm so glad that I don't have something stuck in my eye right now, right? It's just not the way you think.
Exactly. It's a double-edged sword too, because it's like, you know, you forget, so then you are less likely to avoid the behaviors that led to it. So there are times when I'm in the midst of it, I'm saying, remember this moment, you know?
Right. And so would you have warning signs? Would you know it's coming before pain would set in?
You know, it's interesting because there definitely are warning signs. Oftentimes, they're not appreciated unless it's in retrospect. But you can oftentimes say, oh, that's what that was about. So, you know, there's something known as a prodrome, where you'll experience certain symptoms. And these are actually can be viewed as symptoms of hypothalamic dysfunction, but sort of overwhelming fatigue or, you know, burst of energy or feeling excessively hungry or excessively thirsty. So these sorts of things that can precede the migraine, oftentimes by up to a day or so, but you don't necessarily put it together. A few times you're like, I wonder if this is a migraine, and then it comes on. After that, there's what's known as an aura phenomenon, where you can have these temporary disturbances in neurological function. They're usually like visual in nature is the most common. I've had a few of those, but most of my headaches aren't preceded by auras.
Okay. Okay. That's interesting that what you said about maybe feeling hot or cold or thirsty, because that's what the hypothalamus controls. Am I right in thinking that?
Exactly. Yeah. So that's one of the pieces of evidence that sort of, you know, we've long wondered, you know, we know sort of a lot about the pathophysiology, but less so about kind of how it all starts or, you know, what kicks it off. And that's one of the lines of evidence that would indicate that the hypothalamus is kind of the primary generator of the mechanism, is that the very first signs of it in people who experience the prodrome are these times when the hypothalamus is kind of malfunctioning, right? When you're thirsty, but you don't need water, or when you're tired and you shouldn't be, and so on. So it's kicking in these regulatory mechanisms at the inappropriate time.
Do you know how common migraines are in people overall?
Extremely. I mean, it's about one, the estimates are 1 in 5 women. It tends to be more common in women, and probably 1 in 10 men. Those are probably underestimates in my view. Partly depends on sort of how restrictive a criteria you use to define migraine. In some sense, I think that, you know, we should simply characterize headaches as either, you know, head pain in the absence of cranial pathology or head pain with cranial pathology, because the first one is sort of the pain system going awry. And there's a lot of commonalities between those things. So migraines is kind of the fullest expression of that. But I think any type of headache that's experienced without there being any insult to the head should be kind of treated the same way.
Okay. And so you're a neurologist. What if I was to show up at your office and say, hey, I've got a migraine headache, what would the standard of care be?
The standard of care would be first to pick the prescription for you to get rid of your migraine. There's a host of options there, most of which have ended up causing more harm than good. So that's the first step. And then there's kind of two ways that are traditionally treated. That's the first way, which is to choose a medicine for migraine relief when a migraine comes. And then the other thing is there's several classes of medications that are used for migraine prevention. So these are things that are taken every day with the idea being to try to lessen the likelihood that a migraine will come on. And so there are kind of standards that are given for, you know, how often someone needs to be having them to take one of those medications. But that's the main thing. And then the next step is, which some people do, is to try to identify the sort of dietary triggers. And there's kind of a list of foods and so forth that have been linked to triggering migraine attacks that people can maintain a diary and see if they can find those sorts of connections. And that's pretty much the standard of treatment these days in the conventional sense.
Okay. And then how effective are these medicines?
So the preventative medicines aren't very effective at all, despite the fact that we're, as physicians, encouraged to use them. So the studies on them, the sort of best available ones that we have been shown to reduce the number of headache days per month in a migraineur who's experiencing, you know, typically multiple in the teens, reduce the number of headache days by one. So that's a taking something every day to get that type of gain. So the risk reduction percentage-wise, it's fairly minimal. Not insignificant to reduce a migraine, but the question being, is that worth the costs and the risks of being on long-term medication? Mm-hmm. And then as far as the other class that are used to abort migraines or get rid of one that's ongoing, for a long time, there wasn't hardly anything that was effective, particularly that would get rid of a migraine that had been going on for any length of time. And then in the early 90s, a drug called sumatriptan came out, and it was the first in a class of medications called triptans, and there are now multiple. And it was the first thing that would actually that could actually relieve an existing migraine. And its success rate is around 50%. And I can actually still remember the first time my mom took it because it was like, you know, it was the first thing that had ever really helped her. And it was in the form of an injection. So she'd pulled over on the side of the road, injected herself, and got relief within a matter of minutes. And it was, oh, wow. You know, yeah, it was a pretty incredible thing. The downside and something that we've only increasingly recognized in recent years and sort of I've only fully appreciated the full extent of recently is that the medications, while they work on the short term, seem to worsen the condition over the long term. So they make you more likely to experience migraines later on. And that's a function of the frequency at which they're taking. So there's a phenomenon known as rebound headaches, which are when the medication taken for the headaches predisposes you to further headaches and you get stuck in this endless cycle of medication and headache. And that's actually extremely common. And I recently did a chart audit just to see, like, when I'm, you know, seeing someone for the first time, how often they were in that situation. It was about 80%.
Wow.
There's not good statistics on this, but at least in my clinical experience, I think that's going up. The downside, as much as I love those medications that were, you know, the first thing that would ever help, we may have traded this short-term improvement for these sort of turning into a lot more chronic migraine conditions.
Okay. Tell me what you know about the causes of migraines.
You know, I have my own ideas about causes of migraine. The most conventional view that you would hear is that migraines are a genetic condition. That's, you know, for a lot of people ends up being misleading because genetics alone, as it is with almost every other disease, genetics alone aren't enough. There still requires some kind of environmental condition that, you know, releases that phenomenon. But that's been kind of the way it's typically treated is, oh, these are genetic, i.e. there's not a whole lot you can do about them. But I certainly beg to differ in my experience with, you know, what's happened since I adopted an ancestral diet has certainly changed my view about that as well. And having worked with so many people who've been able to reverse their migraines using that approach. So I would argue that the evidence is that sort of, as I presented in that talk that you referred to, that migraines are the distress signal of an overwhelmed hypothalamus. The evidence for that comes from a few different areas. Number one, you know, that as I mentioned before, there are several lines of evidence that would indicate that that's where migraines arise, that the hypothalamus is kind of the generator. So the next question is, you know, what's triggering that to happen? And the two kind of really important observations in my mind that came after my experience with, you know, applying an ancestral diet was, number one, that seemed to be an incredibly effective approach at relieving migraines. And number two, as much as I can look, I can't find any evidence that wild humans or hunter-gatherers experienced either migraines or other forms of headaches in the absence of any type of cranial trauma. So those two things would indicate that there's something about our modern diet and lifestyle that is the environmental trigger that releases that whatever genetic predisposition exists for them. And if you then look to see, you know, where in the brain, you know, what part of the brain would carry the greatest burden or would be most stressed by the way we eat and the way we live now, you know, the hypothalamus is a pretty good candidate. You know, its job is to maintain homeostasis or, you know, keep the internal state of the body, keep those conditions stable. And, you know, it evolved under a very different environment than the ones we're living in now. The greater the gap between our ancestral conditions and our current ones, the greater the homeostatic burden on the hypothalamus. And, you know, you can conceive of migraines as a reaction when the hypothalamus homeostatic capacity has kind of been exceeded or is being strained. And that fits with what we know of as the biggest triggers for migraines. So we've long known that not getting enough sleep is a huge trigger, or any type of disruption in circadian rhythms. Mm-hmm. If we know that there are, you know, certain range of foods, and I would argue that probably the biggest dietary issue is metabolic inflexibility, or kind of the energy roller coaster that most people are on all the time, as a consistent kind of homeostatic stress.
That's very interesting. So you're saying that people, they're getting squeezed from both ends, unable to use glucose and fat, or is it just one end they're being squeezed at?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, I think most everybody who's experienced being on a, you know, at least the standard diet of carb heavy knows what that's like from an energy standpoint, right? Mm. You experience those fluctuations day in and day out. And one of the most consistent things people say after switching their diet is, I can't believe how much energy I feel. I can't believe I'm not getting sleepy after lunch. I can't believe I'm not wiped out after I get home. All those variations in energy levels are kind of evened out, which, you know, I think the physiologic correlate to that is the ability to mobilize fats, you know, when glucose is low. And so that alleviates the energy issue. And when that's not the case, you know, the hypothalamus is constantly sensing this sort of energy crisis, you know, reason that that those feelings of feeling fatigued, that's coming from your hypothalamus, you know,
right.
That's its way of saying, hey, we don't have enough energy to do anything. You know, you settle down.
Right.
So, you know, that's a clear signal that day in and day out, it's being strained, and that it's, you know, telling us that.
Right.
And I kind of have developed what I'd say the three pillars or the three cornerstones of achieving migraine freedom, and metabolic flexibility is one of them, because that seems to be one of the most critical pieces.
Right.
Once people reach that point, things change dramatically.
So I don't know migraines, but I certainly know that reactive hypoglycemia, you know, that feeling of being ready to eat the guy that's next to you on a bike ride. And
exactly.
It was interesting when I was at Brian Walsh's training, he was saying that he didn't think that reactive hypoglycemia existed.
Uh-huh.
And I asked Tommy about that at the conference, and he explained it, I think, quite nicely. And I think this is right. So what Brian meant by that was, if you were to measure your blood glucose during one of these episodes, you would never see a low number. So mm-hmm. what's going on is your brain is far smarter than that. And it's like, imagine a pilot is doing some aerobatics and the mm-hmm. pilot pulls up and it makes you feel like terrible, like you're going to barf, but you don't actually hit the ground, right? Like nothing bad really happened. Your brain
right.
saved the day before there was really a crash in blood glucose. So it's not really hypoglycemia, but you still feel like shit.
Exactly. Right. And it's more a global assessment of energy availability than just glucose.
Right,
so,
of course, of course.
So if you're having, you know, if you're burning multiple fuel sources, then that's changing and it's using that as its inputs. And that's changing kind of its overall assessment of energy availability.
In your AHS talk, you presented this really nice chart, and I wonder if I could get a copy of it for the show notes, because it really illustrated your point quite perfectly. And do you remember that XY chart where you're showing the amount of stress on the x-axis? They're almost like bars that close in and close in and close in.
Right.
And then once your amount of stress goes over one of those bars, that's when you might see a migraine triggered. And you
right.
talked about some other things which may lower the threshold for a migraine to occur. And I remember one of those was inflammation. So can you talk about inflammation, how that might be a trigger?
Sure. We know there's linkages between inflammatory disorders and migraines. And there's also evidence that the hypothalamus's function is compromised when it itself is inflamed. So the other potential mechanism by which, you know, you could implicate the hypothalamus as a generator beyond just straining its homeostatic capacity is that its function is further compromised in situations where it's inflamed. And so we know that so many of the things that are part of the impact of our modern diet and lifestyle, you know, the root of that is systemic inflammation, and that's we've studied showing that affects the brain as well and the hypothalamus. And so that was another possible linkage to, or another possible vulnerability that's occurring because of our modern diets, and particularly its impact on migraines. I think that graph you're referring to, it was showing kind of the typical homeostatic excursions that a hunter-gatherer might face in the course of their day, than the ones that we would face nowadays, which are much greater. There's probably a threshold. There's a lot of people think that migraines can be provoked in anybody, myself included. A lot of the physiology seems to come from very old parts of our neurobiology.
Right.
So the genetics there probably just reflect how sensitive you are to those homeostatic disruptions. So your particular genetics confer a particular sensitivity. So once you get to a certain homeostatic excursion, you know, that's when it's triggered. Whereas for someone else without the genetic predisposition, it takes a lot more, but it still can be released in anyone.
This, I think, is where the ancestral health lens becomes so powerful, because surely, or either that or the model's just completely wrong, because surely our ancestors had lots more stress, right? They had huge excursions in temperature compared to what we have today. They mm-hmm. may have gone for long periods of time with and without food. So, mm-hmm. I mean, surely there must have been ways they were stressed out a lot more than we are now. So maybe
sure.
it's really what's the problem is that it's stresses that we're not very well adapted to.
Exactly, right. So it's, you know, whatever environment, if you're thrown into a completely novel environment, no matter how stable or unstable it is, if it's not one that you've been adapted to, then the hypothalamic functions or all those systems that have been precisely calibrated to the old environment won't work. It's a good framework for understanding obesity as well.
Mm. Talk about the connection between obesity and migraines.
So there's an increased risk of migraines the more obese you are. And conversely, losing weight definitely has an impact in lowering migraine frequency. Now, you know, the correlation, causation, all that is unclear. One of the interesting things, and one thing that kind of led me down the line initially of thinking about metabolic flexibility, was the literature showing that gastric bypass surgery initially seemed to be very effective for a lot of people in reducing migraine frequency. So one of the possible, you know, reasons there is obviously if you're losing weight after gastric bypass, you're increasing the amount of energy being burned from the fat mass.
Mm-hmm.
That phenomenon potentially being protective. Overall, probably the connections between, you know, obesity and migraine are probably best explained by disruptions in energy metabolism mm-hmm. that are happening to cause the obesity. So that probably would be the common pathway. At least that would be my hunch.
Was this ever a problem for you? So seeing Josh in person, he's very, very lean. And it's hard to imagine that you were ever metabolically deranged, but maybe you were. So I guess I'm one of these people too that basically developed insulin-resistant type 2 diabetes without ever getting fat. And, you know, some people would say that diabetes is the price that you pay for not being able to get any fatter. And that may happen at 3% body fat, or it may happen when you're obese. You don't really know. So did you ever check your blood glucose and see if anything was going on for you? I mean, maybe you wouldn't see it in your blood glucose.
Yeah.
Maybe there's some other marker you'd need to look at.
I know. I wish I had. I never did, but it's interesting. Just the other day, I was going back and looking at a picture of myself. This is probably about 10 years ago. And I've never been overweight. I definitely lost weight when I switched my diet, probably about 15 pounds, and then it stabilized. But I looked unhealthy. There was this kind of this bloating around my face. And I remember, I mean, I had, you know, developed a little spare tire around my abdomen. So I would not at all be surprised if I was trending towards insulin resistance
okay.
at that time. And that's all gone away. And it was just, we were looking at that. It didn't even look like me, you know, even though nobody looking would say, oh, he's overweight or unhealthy. But
right.
comparing the now to then, it was a pretty dramatic difference. So yeah, I would be surprised if I didn't have some issues with glucose metabolism at that point.
Interesting. Well, we better talk about some of the solutions then. And I wanted you to start by talking about your Angry Birds story that Tommy and I have been telling all over the internet. And I hope we've been crediting you every time. I'm sure we have, but especially as a computer programmer, this one really, really resonated with me. And you first told this story at the Physicians for Ancestral Health, right? And
right.
I think I can link that video in the show notes for this episode. So tell us about the Angry Birds.
So this came out of sort of first thinking about, you know, one of the things that's been, you know, biggest issue in my career as a physician is that, you know, I graduated from medical school in 2001. And really since that time, especially in the field that I'm in of neurology, there haven't been any therapeutic breakthroughs. And if you just look at sort of what breakthroughs we have had in the various domains of medicine, most of the drugs came out, you know, many decades ago, and we still don't really have anything that's significantly better. So most of the things that are the sort of the state of the art for most conditions are medications that were discovered a long time ago. And there hasn't been any major breakthroughs in most spheres in a long time. In the world of neurology, the last big one was sumatriptan, which I mentioned before in 1991. I think anybody who takes a sober look at that thinks, you know, there's something really wrong there, especially when you contrast that with how much technology has changed in other domains and how much we've learned about pathophysiology of disease over that course of time. Mm. So it's not for a lack in a, you know, furthering of our understanding of disease mechanisms, but yet, you know, we still haven't been able to translate that into more effective therapies. So, you know, there's a few ways you could explain that, but in my view, suggests there's something fundamentally wrong with the underlying paradigm of trying to find a drug to treat the conditions that we now face. So the talk that I gave there was that, you know, we've been kind of seduced by our powers with reductionism. So we've learned a ton about the world around us, including how our bodies work, by applying reductionist methods, right? So finding out how things work on different levels of organization down to the molecular biology. And it seems reasonable to think that if we can, you know, once we get to that level, if we can intervene at the microscopic level, then that's where the greatest power is. And that's kind of what the approach has been, is to find, you know, molecular targets for drugs to improve or reverse disease processes. But the analogy there would be to, you know, playing a video game. So I gave the hypothetical scenario of an alien civilization suddenly, you know, finding an iPhone on their planet loaded up with the game Angry Birds. And you have two different groups of aliens deciding they're going to compete against each other to see who can be the best at Angry Birds. So they each go away and train, and one group just plays the game over and over again, you know, getting better and better at playing the game. And the other group says, oh, we're going to be clever. We're going to take it apart. We're going to figure out how it works. And that's going to, you know, be our edge to victory. So they do so, and they get down, you know, to realizing that it's built on this coding language, which ultimately is specifying the moment-to-moment state of transistors and understanding machine language. And so they say, well, you know, we've cracked the code. So, you know, we're going to play the game, not by playing at the game level, but we're going to sort of try to manipulate the source code in real time. And of course, we know that there's not a computer scientist alive who could do anything like that.
Yeah, so, I mean, I can remember trying to do this when I was a kid with some of my first home computers, the Sinclair ZX Spectrum. You take a game, and the technical term is you disassemble it into the machine code, and it's complete noise. Like there's nothing you can do with that at that stage. And even the most talented of programmers would struggle to do anything useful with that.
Exactly. So, but it seems like a plausible idea that you could do that, right?
And
that
you wouldn't do it. I'm sure there's lots of other computer programmers who are listening to this who have also done this. So it does seem like something you should try.
Right. So the team that took apart the Angry Birds and figured that out, they understand a lot more about how the game is made, right? Mm. But the flaw there was in trying to think that intervening at the microscopic level would be the best approach achieving the results at the macroscopic, right? So it would achieve the better gameplay than someone playing at the game level. So the source code there, the analogy being, you know, the machine language is basically us at the level of molecular biology. And, you know, we're far more complex than any computer game. And we understand far less about ourselves at that level. So to think that we can sort of do things by intervening at that level and predict in any way what's going to happen and do it in a way that's going to influence, you know, our biology in the direction we want is a pretty foolish notion just to begin with. And the most effective things that we do, and we know this, are what I would call game level interventions. So there's a good reason why things like sleeping better, eating better, and, you know, removing stress are the most effective remedies we still have that far surpass drugs, because they're all game level interventions. They're all operating upstream and influencing, you know, all these pathways in ways that we don't fully understand, but we don't have to, because, you know, if you just try game level interventions and then assess their impact on health, you can use sort of the body's wisdom at healing and adapting, rather than trying to sort of hack into it yourself, which we're, you know, a long way from being able to do. So this to me is why, you know, we've been stuck for so long in medicine at trying to find new therapeutic breakthroughs, is because our paradigm is just completely wrong. And, you know, we have to go back to figuring out the most effective game level interventions and then using the tools of reductionism to refine those, and also for diagnostic purposes, but not believing that we have the capacity at this point in time to go and monkey with the code and
take. You can sort of do both, right? You could monkey with the code and play the game, but it's really important that you play the game. Like, if you're only going to do one thing, play the game.
Right, exactly. And I think that what probably the most important lesson there is to realize how much harm you can do, right, by monkeying at that level. Like, you know, first do no harm. You know, it's part of the Hippocratic Oath for a reason, and we ignore it way too often. But there's a lot more potential for unintended consequences when you operate at the source code. So the more benign your intervention, the better. the less likely it is to lead to unintended consequences. You know, the safer you are going after something on that level. But you got to be really, really sure ahead of time, you know, that you're not causing more problems with those types of interventions.
So how do we play the game? I hope that everybody listening to this podcast is already playing the game, but how do we play the game? So can you describe in more detail the type of diet that, obviously you can't recommend anything over the internet, but let's say this is for educational purposes. What type of diet would you recommend?
The basic diet that I recommend for migraineurs is pretty much what I'd recommend for anyone who's trying to achieve optimum health and longevity. So, and the mainstay of that is, you know, removing from the diet the things that have been added since the industrial and agricultural revolution first, retaining those things if we have good evidence to believe that they're not harmful. And for migraineurs, I tend to, at least on in the early phase, recommend that they go on the lower carbohydrate side of things. So that seems to have additional therapeutic benefit, at least for a while. And then some people are able to increase that over time. That seems to be a sort of a common thing in multiple areas where, you know, taking someone sort of using an ancestral framework for their diet and then, you know, using sort of low carb on top of that for at least a while seems to be a good kickstart, and then you can kind of become more flexible over time. And that's been the experience with them as well. But maybe it has to do with sort of getting all those, all that metabolic machinery, you know,
that's
towards metabolic flexibility, bringing that online faster, you know, more immediate results. And then once it's on board, you kind of have a lot of little more room to play with. But that's, you know, that's the thing that's worked the best. I think probably the next phase, you know, is that that tends to work for a lot of our people, particularly when we address the medication issue as well. So that's kind of one of the things that came since the book was that I realized that the medications, you know, the ones that are taken to relieve headaches and that rebound phenomenon I mentioned were exerting even more of an effect than I thought. And removing that effect was really pivotal for people. So that was a really important piece. And then the other one being to establish metabolic flexibility. The other thing that we do in some cases, we've used ketogenic diets. So your listeners probably are aware that there are some pretty special things that happen inside the brain with ketones. And the evidence we've had the longest is their effect on epilepsy and seizures. And there are lots of parallels between seizures and migraines. And so for some folks, adding a ketogenic diet for a period of time can add even additional benefit for migraines.
And do you have any idea of the mechanisms there? Do you know if it's ketones as an energy source, or is it a signaling molecule, or something else?
I don't know for sure. One really interesting study that I'd found, which I was surprised had never been reported, was that in animal models, so there's a phenomenon called spreading cortical depression that happens in the aura phase of a migraine. So it's this wave of sort of reduced activity in the cortex that happens before the pain phase occurs. And it's actually a phenomenon that can be induced in any vertebrate animal by just poking around on their brain. And so there was a study that was done where they put animals in ketosis and they weren't able to elicit the spreading depression. So there was this sort of very fundamental piece of migraine physiology that wasn't able to occur in the presence of ketones. Now, we don't know, you know, in terms of, I assume that the mechanisms are probably similar to why they suppress epileptic seizures. There's a range of possible explanations there, but nobody's certain. They do appear to enhance sort of inhibitory transmission, so GABAergic transmission in the brain. So that potentially is one mechanism by which they work, because a lot of the medicines that are used for aborting a seizure work in the same way. But I think that there may be something to do with, you know, energy availability, that in my personal experience and in working with patients, glucose and sugar seems to be the best migraine fuel. Anything that's not that, the brain's running on something besides that, it seems to help break the migraine cycle. But why, you know, the mechanisms at the cellular level are still not clear.
Okay. So we talked about diet. You talked about sleep. You talked about stress. Was the you mentioned three pillars. Did I miss some of the pillars? I want to know what the pillars are.
So the three pillars are elimination of mismatched foods and behaviors. So basically eliminating evolutionary discordant parts of the diet and lifestyle. So that encompasses a lot of sleep and stress and foods. The second one is the establishment of metabolic flexibility. And those two are interrelated, but that's where sometimes, you know, deliberately restricting carbohydrates to achieve that, at least initially, can be helpful. And then the third is the elimination of rebound headaches, which is the phenomenon where the medications themselves are contributing to a continued vulnerability to migraines. And I used to think that it was, you had to consume them fairly frequently for that to occur. I think that probably the vulnerability lasts for a lot longer than we realized, even after just one dose. And the downside is that the more effective a drug is for migraines, the worse it seems to be about doing that. That's one of the three pillars, because I realized that ignoring that, you know, was one of the things that would frustrate progress the most. So those are the three.
Okay.
Mismatched foods, yeah.
And what do you do with someone who's doing all of those things and they're still having migraines? Does that ever happen?
You know, it's always hard to say. I think yes and no. It's not been the case where people don't make progress. So a lot of it is figuring out what the time course is going to be, which is going to be individual for one person to the next. And there's so many factors that contribute there that it's always, you know, difficult to tell. And you kind of have to take the bird's eye perspective to know, you know, is someone continuing to make progress? I haven't had a situation where it doesn't work. The main variation is in how long it takes. But I do suspect that there is a subset of people for whom, you know, who don't reach, you know, the level that we would like for them to reach, and that the mechanism there is in the gut, and that if we could, you know, be a little smarter about gut health and healing it, you know, and customizing that to the individual, I suspect that's the sort of the last piece of the puzzle in those people.
Mm-hmm. And do you get lots of patients that report gut symptoms as well as their migraines?
We do. There's definitely an increase in gut symptoms in people with primary headache disorders, including migraines. So there seems to be a link, whether, you know, what direction it's occurring. But yeah, there's definitely overlap there. And I think there's also some fairly compelling reasons for people with migraines to be particularly mindful of their gut health. Mm-hmm. I wrote something about the connection between the gut and celiac disease and migraines on the blog recently about that topic.
Yeah, that was a really good article. And I'll link to that in the show notes, along with your website, mymigrainemiracle.com, which has some fantastic resources. Is that the best place? Where would you send people now as your best resource? Would you have them read the book, The Migraine Miracle? Or would you come to the website and have them sign up for something else?
So there's on the website, yeah, there's probably the best place to start nowadays is a place on the website, which is the ultimate guide to migraine freedom. I think it's mymigrainemiracle.com/migraine freedom. So they can download that there. And that's kind of a big level view of what I talk about in the book, kind of with the modifications that I've added on since then, particularly the piece about the medications and the importance of metabolic flexibility. So they can start there and then dive in with the book if they want sort of more of the backstory as to why this came to pass and why this works.
Okay. And talk about what other support you provide. So if someone needs a bit more help, you do some plans and technical support, right?
Right. So yeah, one of the sort of overarching missions I've had since this, you know, happened was how to figure out a way to reach more people with this, because they weren't, you know, they weren't going to be getting it in the conventional system. And just being able to align myself with people who were receptive to what I had to offer. We have a Facebook group, which you can join when you go onto the website. And we have several resources that folks can sign up for. One of those is we've done a meal plan. So we had a lot of people who would say, I want to do this, but can you just tell me what to eat? So we've created a meal plan people can sign up for, which is a weekly set of recipes with grocery lists and so on. And it actually has three different options. So if people just want kind of the primary ancestral approach, there's that. There's also a ketogenic plan. And there's a basic plan for people who don't like to use a lot of ingredients. So there's recipes with 5 ingredients or less. So we have that. We also have a paid support community we called Migraine Everland.
You're really good at coming up with names.
So there's that. And we do kind of a weekly group coaching session inside of that. We post a transcript of that every week. That's called the chatter. So that's another thing people can sign up for if they're interested in reading that. And it's kind of sort of highly tailored information for migraineurs. So those things, and the meal plan is called Primal Provisions.
Right.
So there's those two resources plus the Facebook group, where it's a pretty active group of people who are kind of all following the plan. And so it's a resource for people who want support along those lines.
Right. I'll link to all these things in the show notes. And I'll also link to the Wall of Inspiration, which you have to come and see. It's unbelievable. So Josh has taken a group of Facebook testimonials and also Amazon.com reviews, right? And you've created this huge montage. I'm looking at this webpage now. And the scroll bar on the right-hand side is about 3 pixels high because this page is so long. And, you know, I wouldn't just urge you to come and have a look at this. I would urge you to share it with somebody who's currently suffering from migraines. I know that lots of people listening to this podcast will already be doing many of the things that Josh has talked about, but I'm sure you know somebody in the office who's suffering from these same problems because it's ridiculously common. And this would really move me. Like if I was having this problem and I saw this page, I'm like, I'm in. It's absolutely incredible that you've managed to collate all these testimonials.
Yeah, that's the idea. And it's far more powerful than me sitting here saying it, you know. So seeing someone who's been there and has gone through the same thing is like you say, it's really powerful stuff.
Right. Yeah, definitely. Well, Josh, we're gonna have to do a separate podcast, I think. So Josh also teaches people how to play the banjo, but I feel like that might be a different podcast, don't you?
Yeah, maybe so. I'd be happy to do it again. So yeah, that's another interest of mine, which is also tied into, I had a longstanding interest in the world of learning and neuroplasticity. And so developed a methodology for learning music that's currently for banjo players, because I play a few instruments, but I consider myself a banjo player first and foremost. So developed a teaching method that's called Brainjo, the merger of brain and banjo. And so, yeah, and I'm actually devoting even more energies to that these days. So I'd be happy to do another podcast talking about that and learning and brains and all that kind of stuff.
Okay, yeah, we should definitely do that. But can you sell me on the banjo? If I've never played a musical instrument, do you think the banjo is an instrument that I should start with?
The banjo is, without a doubt, the best instrument. I'm trying to convince the world of this, but absolutely, it's not only so there's no like pretension around it. That's one of the good things. And so you get to play it however you want to play it. There's many different styles and ways of playing it, so almost anybody can find something that suits them. So it's set up so that you get early rewards, unlike something like the violin, which takes forever to make something pleasing. You can start making pleasing music on a banjo pretty quickly. So if you want to learn how to play the banjo, you can go to clawhammerbanjo.net and start today.
Awesome. Awesome. Can you give us a little sample of banjo music that I can play on the end of this podcast?
Absolutely. I'm going to play it on a gourd banjo. So one of the things I like about the banjo is it's often misunderstood. There are a lot of different types of banjos and a lot of different sounds that the banjos can make. And this particular banjo is kind of related to the instruments that were brought to the U.S. from Africa. So a lot of people don't know the banjo as an African instrument that was then modified here in the U.S. So, but those early instruments were just a hollowed out gourd, like a similar to a pumpkin, that were dried with an animal skin stretched over them and then a neck sticking out with strings. This banjo that I'm going to play you something on is a gourd banjo, and I think you'll find that the sound that you get from it is very different than sort of what people may commonly associate with the banjo, but it's really great. It's one of my most favorite possessions. Thank you.
eyes, and she never was cuckoo till the fourth day of July.
Well, this has been awesome. Josh, thank you so much for your banjo music. I'm very excited about learning more about the banjo, and I'm very excited about all of the fantastic resources that you're creating. So yeah, thank you very much. I'm hoping to connect with you again and have you back on the podcast very soon, because you're obviously a wealth of knowledge and there's so much I want to talk to you about, but thank you.
I would love to do it. We can talk about learning and brains and optimizing brain health. Yeah,
yeah, of course. Everyone cares about that. That's something that everyone really cares about. It's like, how can I make my brain work better? Who wouldn't care about that? That's amazing stuff. Thank you.